This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Joe Winters was born in a time when blacks and whites rarely socialized in the same circles and were not allowed to dance together. Both rules were broken at many concerts that Joe brought to Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium. It was a time when there was only one black police officer on the Raleigh police force. Leaders in the southeast section of Raleigh were ready for more representation. They recruited Joe, and he would become the second black officer in Raleigh. Joe Winters was a trailblazer for the city, but his story has mostly gone untold until now. Thanks to some recently discovered memorabilia, the legacy of Joe Winters is the subject of an upcoming profile in Our State magazine, and the City of Raleigh Museum has curated an exhibit that's on display in the lobby of Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium. Joining us now to talk about the Our State profile and the exhibit is the man who helped curate these newly found treasures, writer and marketing executive Billy Warden. Hello, Billy. Welcome back.
Hello, Frank. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Extraordinary figure, Joe Winters. Tell us what we should know about him.
He really was. From the 1940s, early 40s, to the early 1970s, Joe Winters, the second African-American police officer in Raleigh, brought every major African-American artist to Raleigh Memorial Auditorium, largely. That spans from Jim Crow to Black Power. That's an extraordinary time in our history. And he was a major force in getting Raleigh ready for integration. Those shows he put together, often whites and blacks had to buy their tickets at different places. But when they got to Memorial Auditorium, the premier venue in the capital city, Joe brought whites and blacks together in a way that they weren't together in society at large.
And you said African-American artists, but these are some of the best entertainers in America. These are R&B and soul artists who are at the top of the charts, bringing in audiences, both black and white.
That's right.
Now, they were segregated, right?
Yes.
Technically. So talk about how that worked and how it was that it became desegregated once the music started.
Well, that's a great question. So, yes, the process would start with white folks and black folks buying these tickets at different places. They would stream into Memorial Auditorium. The white folks would largely be ushered up to the balcony, which was considered the better seats. The African-American folks were largely put on the floor in the cheap seats. And then the music would start. Now, in those early shows in the 40s, the jazz shows, people did get up and dance. But it's when rock and roll hits, especially in the late 1950s, and you've got Little Richard on that stage, or Fats Domino, or Chuck Berry. That's where, according to my research, all of a sudden the white folks are streaming down onto that floor and dancing. And it's the community comes together in a way, again, that you don't see every day back in the 1950s.
So tell us how you came to know about this story and it, in a sense, became a public story.
Yeah, absolutely. Greg Paul, the builder, was working on a house in Southeast Raleigh. We had dinner and Greg said to me, "I want to come show you a basement in Southeast Raleigh." Well, who could resist that invitation?
Right.
So I went to this house in Southeast Raleigh, and Greg had found these fantastic concert posters, these tickets for all kinds of shows, all these posters put together by hand by Joe Winters while he's a beat cop on the Raleigh Police Department. He finds the ledger for the James Brown show in the early 60s in Memorial Auditorium. By the way, he spent $10 on the piano rental, $60 on barbecue.
Whoa!
That's a lot of money
on barbecue in those days, right?
These fantastic artifacts. And of course, I immediately rushed to Shekinah and Joe Winters Jr., Joe's surviving children, and wanted to hear the story. They were only too eager to tell it, and together we put together the Our State article and the exhibit at the Raleigh Museum, which will start off in the lobby of Memorial Auditorium.
Shekinah Winters is Joe's daughter, and she is here with us now. You may have come to know the story from entering the basement. Shekinah has known it for a long, long time. Shekinah Winters Baugh, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. Yes, I've known it a long, long time. Simply because I grew up with it. It was a natural that my father was on the police force, but he also had another passion and career in promoting music. And he had the best of the best, and that was his intent, to bring the best entertainment to Raleigh. Most were African Americans, but he did have white entertainers as well. He had even Patti Page, and he had, unbelievably, the Lone Ranger, Had a show that came to town. So that was before my time, but I know about it.
That'd be like one of the Game of Thrones characters.
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I could imagine that. So what was it like? Because he was a police officer. Well, maybe let's go back and tell that story, because I think that's kind of interesting, too, how it is that he became a police officer.
Well, he actually became a police officer because of my grandfather, Charlie Winters, who lived on East Street. And actually, East Street, if people know the history of Raleigh, was the dividing line between African-American community and the white community. And my family had been in that property for many years, went back several generations. Well, the men, a lot of the men in the community would always meet there. My grandfather had a home where he had a lot of people meeting. They were discussing the fact that there was only one African-American on the police force, John Baker, and it was time to have another. My father had just finished St. Augustine's College at the time in math, and he was working here in Durham and with the insurance company. But he was sort of volunteered, and he was a dutiful son, and he followed through, and he became the second black police officer on the force.
And a good one at that. And I understand there's a story about, in fact, one of the most famous stories or busts that he was involved in was a bank robbery, right?
Yes, there was a bank robbery. And he, back in those days, you didn't have as many or you didn't have as much crime, I would say, in our city, fair city of Raleigh at the time. So he and Mr. Street, T.T. Street was his name, were patrolling, and this car that had come across, they gave the license plate and the car description. It was actually what was the person who had robbed the bank. And they went up to the car, and this is what my father never believed in pulling your gun, but they did pull the gun then. But he wasn't ever happy on a trigger, because the gun the bank robber had turned out not to be real. It was a toy gun. But they did arrest him. They pulled him out of the car and arrested him.
They stop a car. Somebody in the car pulls out a gun. It turns out to be a toy gun.
He has a gun on the seat.
He has a gun on the seat.
And he matches the description,
wow,
both car and man, and the description of the bank robber.
Your father doesn't use his gun.
He doesn't use his gun.
He had a theory about that, too, didn't he?
He absolutely did. He felt that for a police officer, their best method of defense was their mouth. If they could not talk their way out of it or handle it by that, they were in trouble, and you just didn't pull your gun.
Wow. Well, and that was the same theory that applied as a manager and a promoter, right? I mean, the relationships he developed with other managers was key, I guess.
He had incredible relationship with the artists and their managers. I witnessed this as a child. We picked up Ray Charles at the airport, the Raleigh airport. It was close to midnight. I probably shouldn't have been up, but I was daddy's girl. And Ray Charles and his manager, Joe, also got in our car. I sat in the back with Ray Charles, and he says to my father, "Joe, you should have seen the lightning." And I'm looking up going, "He can't see. What is he talking about?"
Ray Charles could do all sorts of preternatural things.
Yes.
You know, one thing that should be noted about that him being a concert promoter is what a tough business that was. It's not that when Joe Winters was doing it, it did not have the corporate gloss on it that it does now. It was a really tough business. We get into that in the Our State article. Very demanding. The relationships were so important. And so here was a guy who was walking a beat for 8 hours, coming home and doing another whole shift to bring these concerts to Raleigh and to continue to be successful doing that, because he believed that bringing together people around the finer things, as he liked to call it, was important.
Well, what was that like, though, living at home? Did you see him much?
Sure, I did, because he did his work in our office. He had an office in the basement. He made the posters and the flyers in the basement. He advertised. He had a truck, a panel truck, that he would put the billboards on, and he would drive them to various sites and put those up. So I saw him working at home, and he had time to help me with homework. He also liked to cook our breakfast. Being a police officer, you have to remember the shifts. You had shifts, so it wasn't like 8 to 5 shifts. So sometimes he would work through the night, and then he'd catch a little sleep.
And did you get a sense that that everybody on the force was kind of with him and trying to support him?
Absolutely. I think he had a very good relationship. Yeah. The relationship at the auditorium, Raleigh's auditorium, Memorial Auditorium, was fantastic because they knew he was a police officer. Mm. They knew he was a trusted citizen. So we sort of had full range of that auditorium. When a show would come, I would be around, running around. I knew how to get backstage. I knew all the stage hands. They knew that was Joe's daughter. It was a different time. It wasn't. So I walked into the dressing room with Diana Ross when she was here. And, you know, I remember meeting her, and she had not been to Raleigh before, because if you remember, the Supremes were at the bottom of the Motown Review. If you look at any posters, they were there. It was Mary Wells in the beginning at the top.
And, yeah.
Can we mention one close encounter that you had that I think bears special mention? And that's the Nat King Cole incident.
Oh, yeah. Please tell us about it. That's an incredible story.
Well, Shekana. Many people may not realize, but Nat King Cole was attacked on the stage in Birmingham, Alabama. And at that time, his wife, Maria, was traveling with him. And he was nervous, but I think Maria was even more. And he decided to cancel all of his future engagements in the South. And my dad reached out to him and said, it's different in North Carolina. This is not Alabama. And you will have our protection here. He knew Dad was on the force. And Dad also said, and you can stay at our home. You won't be in a public place. You can stay at our home. People won't know you're here. And that worked pretty well until a neighbor dropped by. And then the word got out.
Oh, oops, yeah.
And all of a sudden, all our neighbors and friends showed up. But Nat King Cole was quite a gentleman and received everyone well. The story that's always told, I was about 2 years old, so I don't really remember it, but of course I've been told about it. He held me and played the piano. So these entertainers in that time were friends, and the communications is different than you have today.
It was an obtuse piano as well.
Yes, it was, absolutely.
And this is 1956. Nat King Cole has 2 million selling singles to his name. He is a huge star, and there he is at the Winters home. Yeah.
Well, another huge star who got big, unfortunately for Joe, in the middle of the negotiations was Aretha Franklin, right?
Yes, absolutely. So my dad stayed on top of all what was popular, and who, especially if they were good. And I remember him coming to me saying, I'm trying to get Aretha Franklin and I want to have her. And I really didn't know much about her at the time. And so he booked her and she was supposed to come. And then she became ill or some other reason she couldn't show. And this went on several times. That was before Respect.
Mm-hmm.
Then Respect came out and her price went up
quite significantly. She got very respectable.
She got very respectable. So Dad ended up, he was determined to have her. It was at Dorton Arena, if I remember right. I believe that was
they
where
moved
she was.
It out of Memorial, tried to get it over to NC State, and wound up at Dorton.
At Dorton, because she costs so much now and the Respect had become so large. And it was a very successful concert. Dad didn't make as much money because her price had gone up, but he was so thrilled.
She had to have a late model Cadillac.
She had to, but it was
with a driver.
This was the changing time of the music business. Duke Ellington or Count Basie didn't ask for all these things, but by this time, and we won't put it on Aretha. She was a wonderful person.
Well, an amazing star.
It was the change of the business.
Yeah, and the upfront for Aretha was about $120,000 in today's dollars, what she was asking for in the late '60s when Joe did that show. Joe is a cop. I mean, so he has limited means, and here's this superstar saying, I need 120 up front.
Right.
Yeah, and that it was even a little bit different because you could use your relationship back in those days and not front all the money. And that's a little bit about how things had changed. Before we get there, talk about these relationships and Duke Ellington. I guess there was a time where, again, a personal relationship yielded at least an effort on the part of Duke Ellington to mitigate some of the...
Absolutely. I was quite young, younger than 11, I believe. And Dad had Duke Ellington. And at that time, big band had died down. We were going more in rock and roll sense. Mm-hmm. So the concert was not overly successful. This is after the concert. Everyone's gone. And as I mentioned, I was a daddy's girl, so I'm following him around. Duke Ellington comes out and my father, and they sit on the main floor of the auditorium, about halfway back from the stage. And I know I don't get in their conversation. I go sit behind them. And Duke, I'm staring at him because, first of all, I have never seen a man with a ponytail. or bags under his eyes that was so large. So I'm just staring at him, and he turns his head. I can see it like it was yesterday. He turns his head to my father, and he says, "Joe, you didn't make any money tonight." And he said, "No, we didn't." And he turns back to my father and says, "You don't owe me any more money. In those days, you paid half up front and then half either at intermission or the end." Duke Ellington took half of his money that night because he knew that my father didn't make any money.
Talking about the legacy of Joe Winters, police officer and concert promoter. We're talking about that today on The State of Things. Shekinah Winters-Baugh is my guest, along with Billy Warden, who wrote an article for Our State magazine that's coming out soon, and also curator of the Joe Winters exhibit. Give us a sense of the landscape, because it was changing at that point, and it became much more difficult to be a kind of a one-person promoter those days, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The stars of the pop world were becoming superstars, and folks were seeing what the Beatles were doing, and the phenomenon of that, and pop culture was getting smarter about creating these superstars. You would start to have to front money, not only big money for a one-off from Aretha Franklin, but you'd have to start buying shows in blocks. So you'd have to start buying like a dozen shows. And that is the groundwork for what we, you know, Ticketmaster and Live Nation and the way we do it today. Totally different business than what Joe Winters was in. But Joe, and by then Joe Jr., hung in there for a few more years and wrapped things up in the early 70s. But that wasn't the end of Joe. He brought back Ray Charles for a big benefit concert for Shaw University.
Yeah, and stayed very active and busy even in his retirement, didn't he, Shaw?
Oh, absolutely. He did some work on behalf of Shaw University. We mentioned Estee Hall, which was the first dormitory for African-American females in the country. It was on its last leg and was going to be demolished. And Dr. George Dedenham, who was very close to Shaw and attended, reached out to my father to help save that hall. And they mounted a campaign to save it and included the concert with Ray Charles.
Did your father, we talked about the fact that he helped to integrate the police force. He's got this de facto desegregation going on in his clubs. But, I mean, he's a businessman. He's trying to make money. And I wonder if he talked to you about the social impact, if that was something on his mind or just incidental to what he was doing.
Oh, I think it was on his mind. The first and foremost thing, I think, was he got a taste of promoting in college. And he was very active at St. Augustine's at the time. And he wanted to bring quality music to the city. And he watched through these concerts the impact it had both on whites and blacks. Mm. And so that it was, could bridge the divide. And it was something that everyone left the concert feeling fulfilled and happy. So it was all a positive impact on the city that he loved.
I want to thank you both for being on this program. Shekinah Winters-Baugh is a producer for the exhibit and events that take a look and reflect on the life and career of Joe Winters. Billy Warden is a marketing executive and the writer of an upcoming profile of Joe Winters in Our State magazine, curator of the Joe Winters exhibit on display at the lobby of Raleigh Memorial Auditorium. Before I let you go, Billy, tell us what we see. What's on exhibit? What's on display?
I believe the J. Edgar Hoover commendation letter is on display, which... is quite unexpected. You'll see some fantastic posters that some of my design friends in the Triangle have just drooled over that Joe put together in his basement. They just look fantastic. There are snapshots backstage, Sam Cooke backstage, Lena Horne backstage, the ledgers that I mentioned earlier, a handwritten contract with Bull Moose Jackson, the famous blues singer. It's about 15 words long, all handwritten. That's the contract. I mean, it's amazing. And February 24th, Sunday, in the afternoon, we're doing a big reception in the lobby of Memorial Auditorium.
Billy Warden and Shekinah Winters-Baugh, thank you so much. You can meet Shekinah and Joe Jr. during that reception for Joe Winters' exhibit Sunday, February 24th at Raleigh's Memorial Auditorium. And we have that on our website, stateofthings.org, in case you missed it. Just ahead, they're back from the International Blues Challenge in Memphis. Chicken Shack Live. Stay tuned.